This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today, Andrew Bacevich, is a political scientist, military historian, and author of several books, including his latest, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. A graduate of West Point, Bacevich went on to serve in the Army as a career officer for 23 years. His son, also an Army officer, died fighting in the Iraq War in 2007. In his book, Bacevich says Iraq is just one example of a much larger problem, what he calls needless, costly, and ill-managed wars, violating simple standards of fairness and undermining authentic democratic practice. The fundamental problem, he says, is our shift to an all-volunteer military, creating a culture in which, for most people, armed conflict has become an abstraction and military service something for other people to do. One possible solution, Bacevich proposes, is required national service for all young Americans, maybe military for some, but also work in the environment, healthcare, education, or other social services. This hour on The Exchange, military historian Andrew Bacevich on his new book, Breach of Trust, will look at some of the themes he raises, and let's hear from you. Do you agree with Bacevich or not that we failed our soldiers? If you or a family member served in the military, what's been your experience? And how do you feel about his idea that we might want to think about getting rid of the all-volunteer armed forces? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Professor Bacevich joins us from the Boston area. And Professor Bacevich, welcome back. It's really nice to have you.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program.
Well, let's dig into some of the problems that you outline with this all-volunteer military. It's been 30 years, from what I understand, almost exactly, right? 1973?
Yes, that's correct.
So the last war we had a draft, or conscription, was Vietnam, and it's there that you say that it just broke down. Remind us how.
Well, I think, to put the issue in a somewhat broader context, I'd want to remind your listeners that from the founding of the Republic, the basis of the American military system was the citizen soldier. We didn't keep large standing armies during peacetime. Rather, the practice was when an emergency came, let's say secession in 1861 or Pearl Harbor in 1941, the president would turn to the country to raise up a great army of citizen soldiers. And this citizen army then would go do what needed to be done in order to secure our most important interests. And indeed, the practice was that once the mission was accomplished, the citizen army, for the most part, melted away. What happened in Vietnam was that the citizen army collapsed under the duress of that long war, divisive war, I think in retrospect, utterly unnecessary war, and the American people, I think, chose to abandon that tradition of the citizen soldier. Richard Nixon ratified that by creating the all-volunteer force. So now the foundation of our military system is a professional army, which has become disengaged from the American people. And to my mind, that disengagement has allowed political authorities in Washington to misuse that military and to abuse our soldiers, even as most of us sit on the sidelines claiming to support the troops.
So what was the conversation at the time during the Nixon administration about, yeah, maybe we need to change this? I mean, there was some thinking that this draft had not worked. You were sending people over there who really didn't want to be there. There's some stories in your book about what happens when you have people who really, really are angry and resentful that they're there.
Well, the thinking, I think, on the part of people like President Nixon himself was that although he ran for office in 1968, promising to end the war, indeed saying that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. In fact, when he became president, there was no secret plan, and his policy was one that looked to prolonging the Vietnam War as he struggled to find a way to extricate the United States without suffering a humiliating defeat. So in other words, he needed to buy time. And one way he thought he could buy time to prolong the war was by ending the draft, by basically cutting off the anti-war movement at its knees. So his purposes were rather cynical. On the other hand, if you look at what the interests of the officer corps were at that point, as I describe in the book, the good order and discipline within the United States military, and in particular in my former service, the U.S. Army, had almost collapsed. Rampant drug abuse, acute racial tensions, attacks on leaders. Remember the term fragging. And so, from the point of view of the senior officers, getting rid of draftees who didn't want to be there seemed to offer a way to restore order and discipline, and to begin to recover from all of the adverse effects of Vietnam. There were a few people at the time. Most interestingly, I think General William Westmoreland, who had become chief of staff and yet is remembered as the failed and discredited commander in Vietnam for several years. Westmoreland, in fact, warned about the danger of allowing the people to become disengaged from their military. And I think in retrospect, his warnings turned out to be prescient.
Well, and I don't remember fragging. What was that? Is that sort of lower-level guys? And that's okay. Lower-level guys attacking their commanders? Is that what that means?
It was an informal term for attempted assassinations and sometimes actual assassinations.
Yeah, there's a story about that in your book.
I describe in the book an assassination of a captain in the unit in which I was serving in early 1971, where a young soldier just gunned down this officer and murdered him. But a very common approach to assassination or intimidation was to toss a fragmentation grenade, a hand grenade, into the quarters of the leader who was being targeted. And the short term for that was fragging.
I see. Wow. Okay.
It was not a happy time.
No. And the story in the book is chilling. One more question for you on this before I invite our listeners to join us. Is there a point there, Professor Basevich? You know, you say that the officer corps was really concerned about, you know, the sort of breakdown of discipline and order and morale with these guys that didn't want to be there. So do they have a point?
Oh, they absolutely did. I mean, to put yourself in those circumstances, and indeed I was in those circumstances, albeit as a very junior officer, at that moment, the prospect of moving from a force based on draftees, at least to a considerable extent, to a force that would consist entirely of volunteers was immensely attractive. And to emphasize, in the near term, it worked splendidly. It took a while for the all-volunteer force to gain its footing, but by, let's say, 1990 or so, around the time of Operation Desert Storm, we had indeed acquired a force that was competent, effective, disciplined, people who wanted to serve. All that's good. The bad part, I think, comes when you consider the post-9/11 period. What we see post-9/11, to my mind, is a people disengaged from their military, allowing, I mean, to get down to specifics here, the George W. Bush administration to undertake a foolish global war on terrorism that included a utterly reckless invasion of Iraq, remembering that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Further, the wars begun by the George W. Bush administration, expecting this professional army to win handily, turned out to be wars that we haven't been able to win. So the people having disengaged from these wars, we allow our professional soldiers to, you know, be sent back for repetitive combat tours in conflicts that can't be won and won't be won. We didn't win the Iraq War. We're not going to win the Afghanistan War. If you look at the record of the citizen soldier, setting aside the notable case of Vietnam, citizen soldiers tended to win. You know, we won the Civil War. We came out on the winning side in World War One. We won World War Two. So my argument is that notwithstanding certain limitations of citizen soldiers, as a basis for an American military system, they provide an approach that is more democratic and more likely to yield a positive outcome, meaning wars that end successfully with our political purposes having been accomplished.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, Professor Basevich, and then a bunch more calls, questions for you there. The number for you to join our conversation with Professor Andrew Basevich, he's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, a retired U.S. Army officer of 23 years, is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Andrew Basevich will be speaking about his book at the Music Hall on Tuesday, October 15th at 5:30 p.m., presented by the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org. The book is called Breach of Trust, and there's a subtitle there, Professor Basevich, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Taking the second part first, how Americans failed their country, that's the point you were just making, right? Where, you know, if we're disconnected from the military, then we're less picky about what wars we enter. Is that what you mean there?
Exactly right, and less likely to be successful. I mean, I'm not a pacifist, but I believe that war is an evil thing and that therefore we should engage in war only when the most important purposes are at stake. And when we do that, we should do it in a serious way that commits the country to the enterprise and therefore is more likely to achieve success. What we have in the over the past decade plus is we enter into frivolous wars that we don't win, that cost us enormous amounts of money and considerable sacrifice, and that end up being failures.
Again, the phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. After a super short break, we'll start hearing from you. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And after a break, more with Professor Andrew Basevich on his book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And there's just a week left to wrap up the NHPR Sustaining Member Challenge. You may have received a letter about this. When you become a sustainer today, you'll help us meet the challenge and claim $10,000 from the Mackinich Foundation and cancel a day from our fall fund drive. Join the family of sustaining members today at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the University of New Hampshire School of Law, hosting a look at cyber war with national security expert Stuart Baker, Thursday, October 10th at 5:30, law.unh.edu. From New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion on the web at nhoc.com. And Select Wood of Portsmouth, providing contractors and homeowners with sales and advice on materials, including specialty lumber, featuring doors and windows by Marvin and Integrity. SelectWood.com. A partly to mostly sunny day around New Hampshire today, highs mid to upper 60s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Professor Andrew Basevich. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Breach of Trust, How Americans Have Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Again, let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Do you agree with Professor Basevich or not that we failed our soldiers? If you or a family member have served in the military, what's been your experience? And how do you feel about his idea that there are big problems with the all-volunteer armed forces that we have today? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Professor Basevich, a lot of people who want to talk to you, so let's go right to the phones. And Aaron's calling from Alton Bay. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to, you know, actually ask Andrew, it's a fascinating question here, this feasibility of taking what we have as a volunteer military force and making it one that is compulsory, similar to other nations in the world, like, you know, Israel, for instance. You know, because we clearly, obviously, have a very senselessly jingoistic population, from the way we indoctrinate our kids with the pledge to, you know, singing the national anthem at ball games. I mean, we currently use our military as an instrument, one of one that we euphemistically say, you know, protects our, quote, national interests. But really, it's just a junior partner, our government, the way we use our military in, you know, using it for corporate, you know, what is really a corporately controlled national interest. And it obviously wreaks havoc with our population and decimates families.
So what do you think, Aaron? What's your main question here for Professor Basevich?
The main question here is that I think it would be wonderful to see and if we could take a military and make it like Andrew's suggesting here. If everybody had to be in, then maybe we'd think twice about, you know, about sending people into war. And, I mean, gosh, it'd be great if we actually could use our military right here at home to help build bridges and have social projects undertaken, or even abroad, if that was actually what our national interest showed.
Okay, Aaron, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Professor Basevich? Thanks, Aaron.
Well, Aaron didn't quite accurately summarize my view. I'm not proposing universal military service. We don't need to have every young person, you know, join the military and be conscripted. And I think actually conscription per se is politically not at all feasible. What I am suggesting is it's time for us to consider a program of national service.
Not necessarily national military service, but service, yeah.
Yes, that is to say that all young people, let's say 18-year-olds, will serve a term of service to country and or community. As you suggested in your lead-in, some of them serving in the military, the remainder serving in other capacities. Now, that, too, I think would be a tough sell, because it does, in a sense, the premise of that is that citizenship entails obligations, not just rights and privileges. I'd like to see that conception of citizenship be adopted, but it will be a tough sell. And my view would be that a first step would be to have someone like President Obama in his second term, not running for re-election, create a presidential commission on national service to evaluate the pros and cons and, in effect, to serve as a vehicle to begin to educate Americans into this notion and perhaps put it on our national political agenda. But not universal military conscription, rather national service, which would include military service as one option.
You know, that would be a huge, I need to tell you this, Professor Basevich, huge change. And given how little Americans like government telling them what to do, I'm wondering if this would ever really fly. I mean, nice idea, but no way.
I think your skepticism is appropriate, and that's why I suggest. I think that it would require a very considerable amount of preparation and education. I think the comparison that I make is with health care reform and the efforts of the late Senator Kennedy, who 25, 30 years ago made health care reform one of his priorities, and who doggedly persisted in insisting that that was something that needed to be addressed. And ultimately, right around the time of his passing, the stars briefly converged and health care reform became a reality. I think that moving toward a system of national service would probably take a comparable period of time and would take a champion, someone with the stature of somebody like Senator Kennedy, who would be the person who would doggedly promote the idea.
You know, one quick follow-up to Aaron's call, and thanks again, Aaron, for joining us. He mentioned other countries, and certainly most people know that Israel does have required national service, but that's a very different country and culture, and of course a lot smaller than ours. What other examples are there, Professor Basevich, of other countries that do what you suggest?
Well, at the present moment, I don't think that there are any.
Wow.
When I was in the Army, this is during the Cold War, the Federal Republic of Germany had a comparable system. They relied on a conscription force. They basically had a rule that all males had to serve, but they created options for young males who did not want to serve in the Bundeswehr, the German army, to serve in other civilian capacities. Now, since the end of the Cold War, the Germans have moved away from that system. I don't know that we're going to find any comparisons, but to tell you the truth, this is one arena in which I think we are different. You're different in the sense that we are a democracy, and we are different in that we have, whether foolishly or not, made this national commitment to military power, that there is a broad consensus, I think. I wish it were a consensus that will be examined, but there's a broad consensus that believes that the United States needs to maintain basically a position of military dominance in perpetuity. So the challenge for us is, how do we maintain this military power and at the same time try to maintain our democracy? And I think the tradition of the citizen soldier is the way to do that. You know, I conclude the book with a couple of quotes from General George C. Marshall. Marshall, of course, was the chief of staff of the Army throughout World War II, subsequently became a Secretary of State and then Secretary of Defense, a truly great American and a truly great professional soldier. That was his calling. But Marshall insisted toward the end of World War II that any post-war U.S. military system needed to be based on the conception of the citizen soldier. To not do that, he said, to embrace a standing army would be to open the door to great mischief. He warned us back in 1944, and I think that that mischief has now come to pass, and his words certainly stand as prophetic.
Well, Aaron, thanks again for that call. And you can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. The guest again this hour, Andrew Basevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired U.S. Army officer. He's written several books, including his latest that we're talking about, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. And let's take another call, if we could, Professor Basevich. This is Dean calling from Putney, Vermont. Hi, Dean. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you, Laura. Professor, I want to thank you very much for starting off your thing by saying that this is a republic and not a democracy, because it seems everybody in this government seems to forget that, because then Al Gore would have been president, not George Bush, and we may have avoided Iraq. But I want to just thank you. I think you're absolutely correct that we are in a non-participatory republic where we should be in a participatory democracy, and it's just shown by nobody in Congress's kids are over there in the volunteer army. I want to thank you very much for your thing, and when are you running for president?
Dean, thanks for the call.
I'm happy to be at Boston University, which is a great institution, and it's been very good to me.
Interesting. Wow. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dean, for calling in. Let's take another one. This is Carl in Canterbury who wants to jump into our conversation. Hi, Carl. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead, Carl.
I'm a big proponent of the volunteer army for the following reasons. In World War One, when you had citizen soldiers, you were just basically looking for trigger pullers, and so you could recruit farm boys that had a history of deer hunting, for instance, and that those skill sets worked kind of well together. But, you know, you're not going to just randomly draft up someone that can do signals interference or, drive an aircraft carrier. I mean, as the technology level of the army really goes up, the likelihood you're going to catch these people in the broad cross-section of America really goes down. I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, Carl's an interesting comment, and I'm glad you called. Do you have any personal experience with this? Oh, looks like Carl's phone went out on us. Okay. Hey, it's an interesting point, Professor Basevich.
Well,
you know, he's right that the technology is... Yeah,
well,
go ahead.
It's an excellent point. I mean, that said, that, you know, advanced technology doesn't necessarily, in all respects, make it more difficult to train somebody. To some degree, technology makes training easier than it once was. But his basic point is a good one. Let's take the case of a fighter pilot. It takes a long time to train a fighter pilot.
Sure.
It takes a lot of money and invested to train a fighter pilot. So we would not want to have our fighter pilots drawn from the ranks of the national service people who basically probably would be serving 2 years and then would leave the system. So if a young 18-year-old or 20-year-old said, I know I need to do my national service, but I want to be a fighter pilot, assuming that the person met all the qualifications, then that individual, in order to acquire the training for that skill, would serve a longer term of service, but would do so voluntarily. If the Air Force decided that it takes, in order to get their money back for training a fighter pilot would require 10 years of service, then the young person who wants to be a fighter pilot would sign up for 10 years, whereas the typical young person would be only serving a couple of years. So you would indeed have to
design the system in order to provide longer term of service for skills that require longer periods of preparation and training.
I want to get back to this other big theme, Professor Basevich, that you raise in this book, and that's this disconnect between those who serve in the military and the rest of the citizenry. Again, you said that it leads to wars that you call needless because people just aren't keeping an eye on it as closely because they don't feel it personally. Some listeners today may be thinking, wait a minute. In the buildup to the Iraq War, they may be thinking, I was not disconnected. I wrote letters to Congress. I protested. I wrote letters to the editor. I was out there and I was ignored. So can you really blame the people, Professor Basevich, or is it those in power, the Congresses and the administrations who, you know, are eager for war, don't want to look wimpy?
Yeah, no, there certainly was a brief period of time. And I think it was around February, if I remember correctly, of 2003, when there were not simply national but international protests against the forthcoming war. They were passionate. They were conducted on a large scale. They were utterly ineffective. That is to say, they were ignored by the George W. Bush administration. And once the war began, that kind of activism went away. My argument would be that if Americans had a personal stake in the war, personal stake because our sons, daughters, brothers were serving, that it would be more likely, nothing's guaranteed here, be more likely that the people would demand accountability. Accountability meaning that there would have to be a better explanation for why a war needed to begin, why it should continue. And greater accountability in terms of demanding competent oversight and management of the war. You know, when you think about the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, neither of which the Iraq didn't end in victory, Afghanistan won't, filled with waste, corruption. Where is the anger? There isn't any. It staggers me that for all practical purposes, the Iraq War has already been forgotten. It's a memory, it's barely a memory. So there are no guarantees in these things. But based on the history, and U.S. military history prior to Vietnam, it seems to me that you can make a pretty good case that when we rely on citizen soldiers, we're more likely to prevail in the wars we fight, we're less likely to engage in wars that we don't have to fight.
Here's a Facebook comment from Bill. And Bill, thanks for this. He says, I would not support returning to the draft. I am against all war. I do, however, Bill says, understand the problem with the all-volunteer military is that military service often seems like a good choice for young people who see no other economic opportunity. Bill says this is wrong. The all-volunteer military should not be made up of mostly volunteers of poor people who see no other way to survive. That's the economic issue, Professor Basevich, and it's out there, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I think maybe Bill is overstating it a little bit. It's not as if that the military is filled with people from the underclass. That's simply a bit of a distortion. But the military is not representative of American society, and particularly, it does not contain representatives of the American elite. And there you kind of get to the point of, you know, how many sons and daughters of members of Congress are serving, and the answer is a precious few. So we want the elite, the people who decide things, whether they decide things in Washington or in universities or in corporate headquarters or in the editorial board meetings of the New York Times. We want the elite to have a connection to the military, so that the elite's behavior then in setting down basic policy will take under consideration the implications of going to war. That hasn't been the case since the creation of the all-volunteer force.
You know, it's interesting you talk about elites, Professor Basevich, and we've talked already this hour about Congress and administrations in the White House and how more and more they don't have sons and daughters serving. In the book, you also take some time out to criticize the media elites who have no personal connections to war. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that in many quarters of the media, influential quarters, the the end of the Cold War and the creation of the all-volunteer force resulted in exaggerated expectations of what military force can do, that these people, for the most part, innocent of any direct military experience themselves, came to assume that all we had to do was to unleash U.S. military forces and victory was going to be assured. Certainly, that expectation was widespread among those promoting the invasion of Iraq back in 2002 and 2003. And these are the people then who ought to be warning against the danger, the risks, who ought to have some sort of a watchdog role in being concerned about the well-being of the troops, who I think failed and who became war promoters rather than people who keep the government in check.
So to Bill's Facebook comment again, you're saying the military, the all-volunteer military, is not completely made up of people who see no opportunity elsewhere. But he's right in that the country's elites, those at the top in government and media and business, they're not, you know, they don't really have any skin in the game, so to speak.
Skin in the game is exactly the phrase.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Bill, for the comment on Facebook. NHPR Exchange is our Facebook page. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So when you have fewer people in the military, this all-volunteer force, you write, Professor Basevich, about the role of military contractors. And there was a lot of attention to this in Iraq, wasn't there?
Well, and in Afghanistan. I mean, the issue was this. The politicians and the generals who launched our wars, post-9/11 wars, expected them to be short. They naively expected that we would win quickly. When that turned out not to be the case, we ended up with too much war, too few warriors. And because the people had been encouraged to stay on the sidelines, there was no easy way for Washington to increase the size of the military. And to fill the gap, that's where the contractors came in.
Yeah, and you write about some problems with that. And I will ask you after a short break. So stay with us, and we'll also take your calls at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
There are just days left in NHPR's Sustaining Member Challenge. You can help us collect $10,000 from the McEninch Foundation by becoming a sustainer now. So if you've received a letter from us in the mail about it, and even if you haven't, please become a sustainer for just $5 or $10 a month. You'll help NHPR collect $10,000 and cancel a day from our fall member drive. Call 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Ford & Associates PA, providing representation for businesses, trustees, and institutional creditors in bankruptcy and troubled debt matters. Ford & Associates PA. Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnace, boilers, and water heaters at justcallheritage.com. And Plymouth State University, offering graduate courses in Plymouth and Concord to meet the needs of working professionals throughout the state, registering now for winter term.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest today on The Exchange is Andrew Basevich, a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired U.S. Army officer with 23 years in the service. His latest book that we're talking about this hour is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Andrew Basevich will be speaking about the book at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Tuesday, the 15th at 5:30, presented by the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. And for more information on that event, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. And Professor Basevich, before we go back to our callers, and I do have some people who want to jump in with you, we were talking about the role of military contractors, and you said in Iraq and Afghanistan, the planners for these wars thought they would be short when they started to drag on. As you said, we had too much war and not enough warriors, so in come the contractors. What are some of the problems that come up with these contractors?
Well, war has always been a profit-making enterprise for some. I think we have not appreciated the extent to which war has become primarily a profit-making enterprise since 9/11. In both Iraq and in Afghanistan, ultimately, the number of contractors
outnumbered the number of U.S. troops on the ground. That's how large the contractor presence came to be.
What sort of contractors? Are they fighting? Or are they supplying food?
They are performing in a wide variety of functions, but in essence, encroaching on responsibilities that we once took for granted would be performed by soldiers themselves. Everything from transportation to security maintenance and indeed to some degree fighting. If you think about the experience of the role of Blackwater in the Iraq War, and these are people who work for institutions that have really only one motive, and that is to fill their pockets with as much money as they can. So what does that do? It opens the door to widespread corruption, which has been detailed even by government reports. Some of them I cite in the course of the book. And again, in a sense, it doesn't surprise me that somebody interested in making money from war turns out to be incompetent and corrupt. What is surprising and troubling is that this happens, and the American people basically don't seem to care. Again, disengagement of the people from their military and from war opens the door to all sorts of abuses.
You know, you mentioned transportation, security, and so forth. These services provided to our men and women in uniform, hasn't that been also provided by the National Guard? We hear about so many National Guard call-ups to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
And indeed, the National Guard is the remnant, really, of the citizen soldier tradition. But to a very considerable extent, one aspect of the tradition of the National Guard's identity is being compromised, and that is that, for all practical purposes, they are becoming adjuncts of the professional military. Now, the prevailing notion pre 9/11. Was that the National Guard would be mobilized only in times of extreme duress and emergency, that symbolized, in a sense, the mobilization of the nation itself in the prosecution of war. What has happened since 9/11 is that lesser-scale National Guard mobilizations have become routine, and National Guard units find themselves on basically a deployment rotation system as if they were members of the regular force.
You know, a really interesting email just came in from Tenley in Manchester, and I'd love to share it with you, Professor Basevich. Tenley says, I would like to join the military, yet when I told my parents this, they immediately became upset and angry with my career choice, telling me to become a police officer or something like that. I decided to go with my choice anyway and am currently in the process. However, I had to keep it a secret from them for a long time. I feel like my choice to help our country, learn life skills, create lifelong connections, and so much more is an excellent choice of career. So why would my family disagree? Maybe they think I'm going to be blown up and killed. I think my family would want to support a great career cause for the country. Here's Tenley's questions. Is this a product of the current times and views of the military, the government, and war? What are your thoughts on such an anti-military view? Tenley, wow, thanks for the email. Go ahead, Professor Basevich.
Well, I don't want to get between Tenley and her.
Yeah, that could be trouble.
But I guess what I'd argue is this, and I cannot know exactly what the family situation is and where her parents are coming from. That said, the gap between the military and society means that we will have ever larger number of parents who don't have any firsthand knowledge of what the military is all about. And, you know, I might be somewhat critical of Tenley's parents if out of ignorance, a lack of knowledge, they immediately condemn the prospect of military service as wrong for Tenley. On the other hand, there are people who are, self-described patriots who will tell their kids they should join the Marine Corps to go fight for their country, and they too may be speaking from a position of ignorance because they don't have any direct experience with the military. I myself am not in the business of promoting military service. I'm not in the business of of telling people to avoid military service. When BU students come to me and ask that question, I say, you need to go inform yourself. You need to find out what it means to be a Marine or to be an Army soldier or to serve in the Navy. And then you make the best decision based on what you can learn about what that experience is all about. So the gap between the military and society means that there's less knowledge about the reality of military service, which makes it more difficult to render reasoned judgments on whether a young person should serve or not.
No, Tenley, good luck with that choice, and thanks a lot for the email. And back to the calls, Professor Basevich. This is Jim waiting in Mason. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead, Jim. Thanks for being with us.
Well, Andrew, I have to commend you, Major, sir. I served in the United States Navy as a general medical officer in the Mekong Delta in 1970-71, and brought back a ton of, well, memories and whatever. My wish is to totally agree with you in regarding this all-voluntary force stuff, which to me represents an army of expedience. It doesn't represent America's youth at our best, because so many are unemployed, uneducated, and the children of fragmented and dysfunctional families paid to die for their country's political ventures. They're essentially mercenaries.
You're saying the people who volunteer now, Jim?
I'm sorry?
You're saying the people who volunteer now are mercenaries? Is that what you're saying?
Functionally, yes. They're, as I said, an army of expedients. And I think that Andrew's call for universal, national, I would say, two-year service for all America's youth, which could include the choices of military or civilian or Peace Corps works, would best represent our country. Because I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
World War II was really the last Ivy League war in which America's fighting forces really represented the broad spectrum of American citizenry.
Sure, getting back to that elite comment and how the elites are not connected at this point. But, wow, what do you think about his point, Professor Basevich? Thanks, Jim, for the call.
Well, I think Jim overstates it in saying that it's an army of mercenaries. I mean, people serve, I think, join, make the decision to join for a wide variety of reasons, and we should respect those reasons. I think I would rephrase the point a little bit by saying not that it's a mercenary army, but that it's become the state's army, become Washington's army. It's no longer America's army. It's no longer our army. And therefore, we have forfeited any say in what the army is expected to do and where it's sent to do it. That has opened the door to misguided policies, wasteful policies. So,
Now that's interesting.
Engagement with the military is at least one step toward trying to restore common sense to our military policies.
So let me pick up on that, because that is real interesting. You just said that the military has no longer become our military, meaning, you know, from New England to California, all of us, but Washington's army, the state's army. In the book, Professor Basevich, you say the state callously exploits those troops. Here's my question. Is it fair to call it exploitation when people today do sign up voluntarily? Nobody's making them do it.
Well, I would argue strongly that it's exploitation. I mean, again, whatever the reason that motivates a young person like Tenley to walk down to their local recruiter and sign up, the fact that that decision is made voluntarily doesn't somehow obviate our responsibility for the well-being of that person. Again, this is where I think you get, to my mind, we confront the hypocrisy of putting bumper stickers on our cars proclaiming that we support the troops and love the troops, but in fact stepping back when they are subjected to abuse. Now, people could argue against that. There are some people who to this day will insist that the Iraq War was necessary. I imagine that when we pull the last U.S. forces out of Afghanistan in 2014, there will be some people who will argue that it was a successful mission. I think those people are blind to reality. The Iraq War wasn't necessary. It didn't end in victory. Afghanistan won't. And therefore, the troops that we sent there, and again to emphasize, many of them for repeated tours, many of them coming home even if not bearing physical wounds, being damaged in other ways, their families having made great sacrifices, to say, well, didn't they volunteer for it, strikes me as not democratic and quite frankly is profoundly wrong.
Let's take one more call if we could, Professor Basevich. And this is Bob in Townsend, Vermont. Hi, Bob. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air with Professor Basevich.
Yeah, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Professor Basevich, I agree with virtually everything you've said. In view of having a volunteer army, what recourse do you think a soldier would have if we had another Iraq? In other words, something that many of us think is wrong and unjust. And then the second question I have, why no accountability for Iraq at the present? I mean, we knew it was wrong. The reasons for it were false. Why has no one really said that? Thank you very much.
Bob, thank you for calling in. Go ahead, Professor Basevich.
Well, I mean, on the second point, why no demands for accountability? My argument would be because the people didn't have any stake in the war.
Most people.
And so the expenditure of ultimately trillions of dollars, the loss of over 4,000 lives, it's not something that has touched the American people. And therefore, the architects of that war, and I would include both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, it's in their interest to forget it, to let bygones be bygones. And they can get away with it because the American people aren't paying attention.
Here's an email that came in. This is from Jennifer in Stratham. She says, I was in a relationship for several years with a recruiter for the Navy. I myself am former Navy. I can tell you with 100% certainty that the recruiters at the time were encouraged to go to high schools that had a predominantly high number of lower-income families. Their target, Jennifer says, young men and women who came from lower-income families. These children saw their lives as hopeless and never leaving their small towns. These children were promised the world. My ex, the recruiter, he admitted to me that in the South and Midwest, this is standard procedure. We touched on this earlier with Bob's Facebook comment, but what do you think, Professor Basevich?
I think that the military is not representative of society, and I think that in particular, it is in the realm of class, in other words, not of race, where the absence of representativeness is most apparent. And so it doesn't surprise me that it is the lower middle class that would be a target. Now, that said, one can exaggerate the point. It is not as if recruiters are going out there and scarfing up the dregs of society. You have to be, for all practical purposes, have to be a high school graduate to get in the United States military, which means that you are that you have some capacity to demonstrate success. So my only caution is don't overstate the point, recognize that what we have is a military that is not representative of our society. And I would argue strongly that in a democracy, it ought to be representative of society.
I want to ask you one last question, and it's something you touch on in the book. More recent military actions, drones, targeted small strikes like the one that took out bin Laden, like the one just about a week ago against suspected terrorists in Africa. Is that the future of how we use this all-volunteer military, Professor Basevich? These very small, I think you even call them secret strikes.
Well, it's going to be the future, I think, as long as President Obama is president. I mean, the president didn't come away from Iraq and his experience with Afghanistan learning nothing. What he learned, what he concluded, is that invading and occupying countries is a bad idea. That doesn't mean that he's a peacenik. What the president has done is to devise alternative methods, alternative techniques, and the missile-firing drones and the raids by special operations forces have become his preferred instrument. Does the reliance on those instruments, as opposed to the Bush preference for in,
invading and occupying countries yield a better outcome? Well, it yields an outcome that may not be as costly in terms of American blood and treasure, but I think it is quite questionable that it achieves a better outcome in terms of advancing our political purposes.
Sounds like a future book, Professor Basevich.
Well, maybe.
The future of these smaller forms of warfare. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much for giving us some of your time this morning.
I've enjoyed it very much. Your callers just ask great questions.
All right. Thank you very much. That's Andrew Basevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired U.S. Army officer. He's written several books, including his latest that we talked about, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Again, if you want more information about Andrew Basevich's appearance in Portsmouth on Tuesday, go to our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are John Barrett and Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
When we hear from 500 new sustaining members by October 15th, we'll collect $10,000 from the McAninch Foundation and cancel a day from our upcoming fall fund drive. We're asking you to join NHPR's sustaining member family by donating $5 or $10 a month to NHPR through your credit card or bank account. Just takes a couple of minutes when you call 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
NHPR 959, the Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dana Center at St. Anselm College, presenting a Far Cry Chamber Orchestra. 17 young musicians redefining orchestral music, October 19th at 7:30. Details at anselm.edu/Dana. And the Maids of Southern New Hampshire providing environmentally friendly house cleaning to the seacoast, Greater Manchester and Concord areas, referred for a reason. MaidsNH.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The ripple effects of a partial federal government shutdown are being felt across the country. In response, Republicans have attempted to pass individual bills that would reopen a handful of popular departments and agencies. But Democrats have resisted.